It's Monday, June 1st, 2020, just after market close here in New York. This is the Real Vision Daily Briefing. I'm Ash Bennington here in New York, joined shortly by Ed Harrison from Washington, D.C. But first, Jack Farley with market news.
Thanks, Ash. Today, the manufacturing PMI was reported in the U.S., and it came in at 39.8, just shy of expectations. A PMI below 50 means that economic activity was lower than last month. So this 39.8 reading indicates that U.S. manufacturing is still in contraction. This, as the S&P continues to perch comfortably above the 3,000 level. Meanwhile, China's PMIs were more hopeful. The manufacturing PMI coming in at 50.6, which was below expectations, while its composite came in at 53.4. China was the canary in the coal mine when the shocking drop of its PMIs in late February put the world on notice. But now that its manufacturing PMI is above 50 for the third straight month, it's evident that China has reached some sort of stasis. But for a true recovery, we're going to need to see those numbers go higher. The Eurozone manufacturing PMI rose to 39.4, indicating a continued contraction. Italy reclaimed some ground with a solid 45.4 reading. And Germany was the laggard with a dismal 36.6. As a result, the DAX was one of the few major equity indices that was sold off today as equities rallied worldwide. In other news, Goldman Sachs has raised its downside target for the S&P. In a report on Friday, Goldman amended their bottom for the index to 2750 from the 2400 level they forecasted in early May. The report reiterated Goldman's year-end target of 3000, but noted that a rally past the 3200 level is something they have their eye on. The analysts argued that, quote, monetary and fiscal support will likely limit downside risk to roughly 10%. So it's clear that these analysts are watching the Fed and Congress. That's unsurprising. But they also have their eye on profit margins. They forecasted net profit margins to decline by 200 basis points to just 8.7%, the lowest level since 2010. But the report also indicated that sustained low interest rates will keep return on equity stable, citing the unusually high level of corporate bond issuance, roughly $1.1 trillion in investment grade so far this year, as evidence that funding for high-quality companies shouldn't be a problem. On the valuation side, Goldman looked at key ratios for the S&P and found that, yes, on a price-to-book basis, the index is quite rich, but that factoring in return on equity, the S&P 500 isn't actually that overpriced. It should, of course, be noted that this model hinges on consensus estimates about earnings growth and a V-shaped recovery in general. So the headline for the day is, uninspiring PMIs fail to deter a global equity market. Meanwhile, investment bank analysts scramble to retroactively adjust their somewhat bearish call in order to adjust their narrative to the new normal. And with that, let's go back to Ash and Ed.
Welcome, Ed.
Good morning, or I should say good afternoon. It's 4 p.m. just after market close. So it's been a tough week, a tough weekend, in fact.
Yes, a very difficult weekend for the country. What are you looking at today, Ed?
So what I'm looking at is I'm looking at the numbers, but I'm also looking at it in regard to previous episodes of tensions, violence, riots that have happened in the past, and trying to get a sense of whether there's any market moving nature to the things that are going on right now.
Yeah. So what sort of specific historical context are you examining when you think about where we are today?
Yeah. So I'm looking at three different crises that we're going through right now. And so I would describe it as one, an economic crisis, first and foremost, when we're thinking about markets and the economy. And so when you look at the drop off in employment numbers and when you look at the drop off in GDP, you can't really see anything in the recent past until you go back to the Great Depression. So there's that as the bogey, if you will, to compare on an economic basis. But then we also have a second crisis, which is the viral pandemic. And in terms of things that have hit the global economy, things that have hit the United States, there's nothing that compares again until you get back to 1918 with the Spanish flu, the flu seasons of 1918, 1919. Now, that's not to say either of those two preceding events are like what we're doing now, but it's just to say that in terms of order of magnitude, there's nothing that we can see until we look back to 90 or 100 years. But now we're looking at a third crisis, I would say, and that's this volatility, social volatility, violence. And so a lot of people are looking back at different sorts of activity that's been like that in the past. There was obviously the Rodney King incidents. We saw in a global way in 1968, not just in the United States, but in Europe and elsewhere, violence of that nature, a cultural clash. But I would also go back and I would talk about the 1932 Bonus Army, the Bonus Army camps that happened here in the DC area as a bogey. So we're looking at all three of those things together.
Yeah. You know, those of us who remember the Rodney King riots in Los Angeles know that it was a much more highly localized scenario than what we're looking at now. I mean, I think it was 27 metro areas I saw over the weekend at one point were currently experiencing a significant civil unrest, I think was the number. That's a significant number.
Right. Yes. And, you know, we're also talking about not just unrest, but just protest in general, because you people are pent up. They're penniless because of the pandemic and the unemployment. And then on top of that, you have these this strife. So when I say protests, we're talking about New Zealand, we're talking about Copenhagen, we're talking about Berlin. So there's a global sort of solidarity on that front. And I think that the closest thing I can think of in the recent past is probably 1968 there. And then the question is does it really matter? Because when we looked at the markets today, just starting in Asia, first and foremost, they were up. They were up in Europe across the board. I think the DAX was down today, but U.S. markets were up most all of the day. So, you know, at least on a very localized one-day level, it has no significance. But then the question is what sort of significance does it have in terms of the economic performance of the United States, of the global economy? And is it a signpost for the economy going forward?
Yeah, you know, to that point, let's just recap markets. So the Dow closed today at 25,475. Essentially, I would call it flat, up about 3.5 tenths of a percent. S&P closed at the 3055 level. That's up 0.38%. NASDAQ rose a little bit more, 0.66%. And the VIX up to 28.25. These are relatively flat numbers, I would say.
Right. Yes. And so, you know, what I would say is the thing that I find the most interesting, actually, is the 1968 parallel, because for me, that's where social unrest I look at as being a marker, a sign of the top of the market in terms of the economy. So if you think back to the bear market, secular bear market, a lot of people started in 1968. The market actually did go up after the protests and the riots in 68. It ended the year up, but that was really the beginning of a very long secular bear market. Some people mark it at 1966. But over that time span, the markets traded pretty much sideways while inflation was ravaging your nest egg. And so it was a brutal bear market on an inflation adjusted basis for most people, losing 50, 60. And I think at points in places like Ireland, when I looked at the indices in the 1970s, 80 and 90%. So what we're seeing, or what we saw in 1968 was is that era climaxed. The post-World War II era climaxed in the mid-60s, and the 68 riots, the 68 protests, that marked an apogee and in the beginning of a secular bear market. So the question is that the same sort of thing that we're seeing today, especially when we're looking at 20% unemployment in the United States, that these protests are a manifestation of angst that has built up over a long period of time.
Yeah, and obviously it's worth pointing out that 1968, those were intensely political times. The key flashpoint there being the Democratic National Convention in Chicago after the assassination of Robert Kennedy. The idea is that they are times where the riots, the civil unrest are irretrievably wed to the political context. And of course, the assassination of Martin Luther King Jr. intensely.
And let me say, by the way, you know, because I went to Columbia Business School, that, you know, Columbia at that time, people took over, you know, they held hostage the administration there, students, people, you know, they went to jail, they were kicked out. You saw the same thing in Paris and in other places, this student revolt, this revolt against the draft in 1968. And the anti-Vietnam War. That was, as I said, this was the climax of a whole period of post-World War II baby boom. And that's when the baby bust was starting to take hold.
Yeah. And to your point about Colombia, this was not something that went back to normal when the sun rose in the morning. This was something that was a state where there was literally a state of siege. It's a few blocks north of where I am now. But it did not abate. So significantly more serious in terms of the situation on the ground in New York City in 1968 than it is today.
Yeah. So, you know, I'm looking at it in that context. And so then the question is, what do we see in the real economy data? One thing I thought was very interesting, just from a real economy data perspective, in terms of the markets as you move forward, say 3 months or 6 months, is the Citigroup Economic Surprise Index. And I was looking at just the index, not how it correlates to other assets. But Ed Yardini, he puts out every day, he gives us an update on the Surprise Index. And if you look at the index, it's interesting to note that, first of all, the index was going up through 2019, and then it had a big fall down in that period where people were talking about the yield curve being inverted and the potential for a recession. But the index only hit sort of the 0% marker. It wasn't one of those low levels that you see that are typically associated with recessions. And then it moved up substantially at the beginning of the year. You could make the claim actually that the U.S. economy, because this is the U.S. Surprise Index, was actually moving out of the malaise that caused the yield curve to invert, and that we were actually in sort of a bullish mode when, you know, that's when the markets actually went up in February. So at the beginning of the year, the economy was going through a spurt, and then it you know, the bottom dropped out and we went way down. And just recently, actually, the Citi Surprise Index has gone up. It's not gone up to zero, but relative to where it is, it's much higher. So what it says to me is that this has given some localized, that is, near-term support to the markets, to the degree that the markets can't see earnings out further because there's a lot of uncertainty about earnings. And that's sort of a safety net for the market in terms of giving it support going forward.
Yeah, you know, it's really interesting. I was thinking in sort of similar ways. You said the point that clued me in was that it hasn't gone up to zero yet. And I was looking at earlier the ISM Manufacturing Index that will give you the numbers. The print here was 43.1 for May. Prior was 41.5. Consensus was 42.7. So above consensus at 43.1. Here's what I find interesting about this. I saw a series of headlines, a series of leads that seemed to suggest that this was a really sort of positive state of affairs. I apologize, there's a fire engine going by outside. But the idea was that, well, you know, these numbers are rising, they're off their lows. Look, diffusion indices are not stocks. When a diffusion index is below 50, it means contraction on a month-over-month basis. So what we're seeing here is the ISM Manufacturing Index contracting at a slightly slower rate relative to the month before. This is not something that we should be excited about, thinking about this as you know, potentially green shoots. These are really dismal numbers. You're looking at an index that's almost 7 full points below the level to stay flat on a month-over-month basis. This is not great data.
Yeah, but you know, the counter argument to that is that actually you beat consensus. You beat consensus on the ISM. You beat consensus on the market PMIs, both in Europe and in China. Actually, China was above 50, and yeah, you know, the PMI data out of the U.S. You also beat the consensus there. So then the question is, how much of that is priced in? How much is the consensus on the economic data consistent with where the market is now? Or Is there more to come? That is over the near term. And then we have to look through that and then decide, you know, how much of that is a linear extrapolation of what we're seeing now back towards the 100% level that we always talk about, where we don't think that we're going to be able to get to. And what does that trickle through in terms of earnings? Because to the degree that, you know, you can't leverage up and buy back shares, obviously, if the economy is growing at a slower level or it's at a lower base, you're not going to be able to increase your earnings per share.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. That is exactly the counter argument. I guess my feeling is it's just hard for me to look at it and see a glass half full kind of scenario here when I see what seems to me at least to be very clearly additional risk coming on to the table in terms of civil or social unrest, you know, in the form of, frankly, riots. And when you look at these numbers, just the mechanics of the way the actual numbers themselves function, it's like, well, we beat consensus. I mean, what does that mean, right? It means that the consensus was that, you know, that it was going to contract at a particular rate, and it contracted slightly less than the rate that it was expected to contract. Every month, these get lower and lower and lower, and you're always dealing with a diminishing base when these things continue to go down month on month on month. So I guess when I look at it, I just see relative to what seems to be just the tone of the news flow and the reaction of equity markets, it seems to me to be a little bit more optimistic than I think the mechanics of the data would suggest.
Right. Yes, I would agree with that. I would say that if you just look at it on a global basis, that is, you know, when you look at 20%, 25% unemployment in the United States, and you think the market's only down 10%, you have to come to the view that the market is not aligned with the likely economic impact that you're going to have based upon those that 20-25% unemployment number. And so what we should see is we should see some hits to the economy and to the markets going forward. But, you know, let me caveat that for a second, because I thought it was interesting. I showed you earlier today a second chart for the Citigroup Surprise Index. That was the Citigroup Economic Surprise Index versus the 10-year U.S. Treasury bond yield. And I thought it was kind of interesting how they tracked one another over time, at least according to the numbers that Ed Yardini had put out. You know, there was the Surprise Index, and then there was the 10-year yield on a 13-week change of basis. And what this chart was suggesting is that to the degree that the Surprise Index moves up or down, you know, the second derivative, you're going to also get a change in 10-year U.S. Treasury bonds in the same direction, meaning that bond yields go up when the Surprise Index goes up, and they go down when the Surprise Index goes down. And this is how I'm thinking about it, just from a framework perspective, is that what that's signaling to you is taking the tail risk off the table, the likelihood that the Fed in the future will raise interest rates over that interim period of time. So what they're saying is that the bootstrap yield curve all the way out to 10 years now has more figures in it with rising interest rates at the base rate level. And so that causes the 10-year rate to go up. And so that's what's been happening now as well, is that the number, the differential from 3 months ago is actually now starting to move in the direction of the consensus, the surprise. And so what that would suggest is that, again, markets are discounting slightly better times ahead based upon the economic data having bottomed.
Yeah, I hope we were able to show that chart on screen, because the correlation is pretty extraordinary.
Yeah, I thought it was interesting. I looked actually to see to what degree the Citigroup Surprise Index, just statistically speaking, is useful in terms of looking at economic data going forward. And I didn't see anything that the only thing I saw suggested that the correlation actually was relatively weak. So I wouldn't, even though the data looked good, I wouldn't necessarily put my, I wouldn't say that this is telling me that in the next 3 months we should expect the market to continue to go to move higher. And I should also caution that, you know, it's been very weak volume. today was very weak volume in terms of the move higher. And the selling that we saw at the beginning during the liquidity crisis was heavy selling volume. My view is basically that the market is, because of the lack of certainty about economic data, is really narrowed its focus to a very limited time frame. And so it's saying we can only forecast to a certain degree, and we're going to take that data. And if it beats consensus, then that's positive. If it doesn't beat consensus, then it's negative. And so we're just going to go with that until we get through this uncertain period. And it's the period after this uncertainty, let's call that, you know, beyond 3 months, that's when we will have the reckoning.
Yeah. You know, that's so interesting, because it almost comes back to my earlier question, which is, to what extent are the consensus numbers almost arbitrary at this point?
Yeah. I mean, at this point, I think that we really just don't know. For instance, the 2Q, the Q2 numbers for GDP in the United States, 30% down, 40% down year over year. I mean, that's a big difference. And we have that wide a dispersion in terms of what people are talking about. So even in the near term, you have a certain degree of uncertainty. You have that dispersion, but obviously you have the consensus. And if you beat consensus, then the market rallies on that. That sort of dynamic is positive, especially during this reopening period, because you're bottoming in terms of economic data. But once we get into a real opening, which will be September, October, then I think things will be quite a bit different. And then we'll be able to actually see whether the market is overpriced and how it reacts in real time. And those are always the fun months of the year, September and October.
Yeah, historically, that's been where the action has been concentrated. You know, some of the things that you said got me thinking about the Ask Me Anything that we did on Friday, and then the RVDB, especially good comments. We got suggestions, analysis, really interesting and well thought out comments that we saw over the weekend. And it's gotten me thinking about, someone asked the question, one of the subscribers, about what I thought what we each thought were the three potential worst case scenarios. And I said three things. I said, number one, second wave of the virus. Number two, the potential for wide scale civil unrest. Mm-hmm. And number three, the potential for escalating tension with China. And I'm curious now, as I think through, so we've seen, today in Hong Kong that police denied an application for the 30 year standing anniversary remembrance of the Tiananmen Square massacre in Hong Kong. They denied an application for a candlelight vigil, which is apparently a very significant social thing in Hong Kong, claiming that there's too much virus risk. Whether or not you believe that probably is in some sense a function of what your view of China is. But what's interesting to me is the relationship between the first and the second. You know, we have wide scale protests in this country, at very least at the moment, and we did over the weekend, and to what extent that potentially elevates the risk of a second wave of the virus. It's very difficult to socially distance during a protest, and presumably even more difficult to socially distance during a riot. So I'm curious, and perhaps a better word than curious would be apprehensive, about what the potential risks are now for a resurgence from COVID-19.
But, you know, even disregarding COVID-19, there's the fact that you're not really going to go out on a shopping spree when the stores are busted up and there's the potential that you could get caught up in some sort of riotous activity, right? You know, let me just give you an example from my own backyard. Literally, you know, half a mile down the road, there was a store that rioters were trying to break into and bust up. The local grocery store just down the road from there was also, the windows were cracked. They stopped people from being able to ransack that place. So it hits very close to home. How do I feel about that in terms of, am I going to go shopping there? Just, you know, walking down the street and decide to go and get me some wine, you know, because this is where we fill up every 2 or 3 weeks. We get a few bottles of wine. I should say actually several bottles of wine, to be honest with you, and go there and come back. You know, you think twice about those kinds of activities. So I think you combine that with the fact that there are reports that Apple has closed some stores, that Amazon has talked about delayed deliveries, et cetera. And then there's the psychological impact over a longer period of time. It definitely will slow the reopening at a minimum in the United States, if not in other places as well. So it does have an impact beyond COVID-19. And I would also say, with regard to the AMA and the RBDB that we did, one of the questions that we asked was, how should we talk about political economy, you know, these types of events? And the answer was that we've come up with is we talk about it in terms of the markets. We talk about it in terms of economics and the markets. Is there any real impact rather than wading into what I would consider to be the fractious debate about what side are you on these political topics? And that's how we're going to do it here at Real Vision, I think, for the foreseeable future. Let me know what you think about that, but that's my take on it.
No, I think that's exactly right. I couldn't have said it better myself. The fractious debate is something that's very difficult to weigh into. I've spent a weekend with, you know, potentially having people send you messages that maybe you don't want to read. I see friends who agree with each other, who seem to be arguing about the language in which they agree. This is a very difficult time, and our remit is to focus on markets. And to the extent that this story is about markets, we're going to be there.
So, you know, the way I would look at it then, sort of to wrap up on my comments for today, is that I see it as the market is, there's so much uncertainty in the market that it has a very limited window in terms of what it's looking. To the degree that you have economic surprises that are to the upside, that's positive for the market. But we're not seeing very high volume. There's not a high level of conviction to those moves. It's only once we get through this reopening period and then we get to the backside where we know for sure that we have reopened. This is relatively normal times. These earnings suggest this is the go forward look. That's when we will see, you know, the big reaction. So you get that July, August lull when people go to the beach and it's the summer, and then September, October, when people come back, that's when they're in a refreshed state of mind to reanalyze and to reassess where we are. I think that's when we'll get the big hits. And so that's the message I would leave with. The last thing that I would ask is, you know, for you, Ash, when you think of one other thing that we were talking about during the AMA is, you know, what piece of information on our platform, what interview on our platform did you see over the last few days that you think that the viewers of RVDB should take a look at? Which interview is it, and what did you get out of it?
Well, I actually really enjoyed the interview with Raul and Bill Tai, who is a Silicon Valley venture capitalist. He is a really fascinating interview. I think it does what really great long form interviews do so well. It tells a story. It tells a narrative. The story about someone who is a chip designer by training, silicon engineer effectively, and telling the story about his transition into banking and venture capitalism, and then telling the story of effectively progress in Silicon Valley, the tremendous strides that have been made in information technology, and understanding the context of it from an economic perspective, from a technical perspective, from a social perspective. Maybe I just loved it because it was such an optimistic story in a time where I felt, and the world probably feels, we could really need one.
Yeah, I think that's a good place to end it. I really felt he was optimistic. I felt refreshed and positive once I saw the interview as a takeaway. And I thought he was a really great explainer as well.
Yeah, a very good explainer in terms of, if you're not a technical person, I think he's really great at framing these highly technical issues in ways that people with finance backgrounds or general business backgrounds can understand.
So we're back at it again on Tuesday, Ash. Hopefully the situation will be a little bit more calmed down, but stay safe. And it was great talking to you today.
Stay safe, Ed. Have a good night.